So I think I've taken Tom's suggestion more literally to exhibit our own ignorance. So what we heard in the last talk were thousand and one questions. Now, sort of Michael successfully conveyed the impression to me that he has at least 1,001 answers.
Ralph, they still want to hear you out there. Excuse me, just going to do something painful.
Okay.
You do that bit.
I'll do that bit. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring back these numbers down. So I'll get rid of 1,000 questions, and the number of answers is going to go down to zero, I'm afraid. Now, what is even worse, this is about my personal ignorance. So I don't have the answer. Michael even hinted at the possibility that he might have it, which is even more unfortunate to me. What I'll do is, one more thing I'll say, I'll put a number one here, and that is, again, polemic, but in terms of methods. Now, experimentalists would, of course, like to increase that by one, but anyways. So, okay, so that's one preliminary. The other one is, now, I've listened to talks now for, well, let's say one day in total, and sort of what strikes me is the following. We're always talking about geometry, cubes, or conformations. And from that we get ideas and develop theories, and then we go to rheology to check if they're any good or not. And to me that's a pretty large step. So that is something that I sometimes wonder if one shouldn't do something in between. Okay. Now, the third thing is about models and theories. Now, the difference, I guess, is fairly obvious, but I say it anyways. A model for me is something which hopefully is, well, is simple, at least conceptually, like the tube model. That doesn't mean that I know how to solve it, but I like it to be there. That's the first idea. And then somebody maybe comes and says, well, I have a theory how to calculate the properties of the model. And mostly what we do, and that was also at the end of this question period before, sort of, okay, we have the tube model, and now we fiddle around with theories trying to improve the our intuition about what the tube model really implies. But maybe one should also look at the model. So again, just to rub it in, let me illustrate that for something which is fairly basic, but which has also been questioned yesterday, and so that gets me worried. Let's take the Rouse model. Now, to me, at least, the essence of the Rouse model is to say that I can describe the dynamics of one chain in that bath of all the other chains by saying there's something like a local friction. Now, in terms of theories, even I can solve it for Gaussian chains. So, for Gaussian chains, that's fine. But that's just for Gaussian chains. And we're only just learning, and that was sort of the first part of this workshop, what happens if you have a less trivial chain model. I mean, if you just say, I have semi-flexible chains, then warm-like chains, then it's only now that a picture is emerging of what this simple assumption here implies for the dynamics of the system. So that is like 50 years after this Rouse model was written down. So if I think about real system, experimental systems, then I'm happy to try and test, well, let's say this assumption here, and not by checking it against predictions of this here. What do I mean by that? I mean, what I would typically do is I would say, okay, I do a simulation of a more or less microscopic model of a melt, and I can follow the motion of a single chain in that melt. So I have a simulation box with all of these chains in here somehow, and then I take one chain out, and I look at its dynamics. Now, if I want to check the model, the Rouse model, then in that case it is relatively simple, because I could say, okay, I take the same intra-chain potentials, and then I solve a Langevin equation with local friction, and I see, does this the same thing as here? And then I think I have checked the model itself, even if I don't know how to solve it for some more microscopic, I don't know, united atom model. And that, to me, seems like something reasonable to do. Now, so I think in this case, it is relatively clear how to go about this. The question is now the tube model. So if we now say there is this confining potential, so we take out one chain, and now we say, well, there is something like a tube, or we say there is something like slip links. How should I do this second part? Just, I mean, we always speak in a single chain picture. So I would like to be able to just generate chains, the dynamics of chains, from the single chain picture for whatever I put in the simulation, and compare that to what is happening in the true many chain system. Now, what I know how to do for tubes is what Mike also hinted at, how to do it if I cheat with this longitudinal degree of freedom. I say, okay, what I really do is I confine monomers at some position in space, and I don't allow them to really do the rotation bit. Now, since I often look at networks, that is not so bad, but I would like to know how to do it for the real case. And to me, this is the question. I mean, let's look at a simulation of the true many-chain system. Let's come up with a model which is at least conceptually simple so that one can solve it. And let's compare these two microscopic things. And only if that makes sense, one should go on and build a complicated theory on top of that model. That's my question. You have, I don't know, half an hour to answer it? Okay, I want an algorithm how I can do a single chain simulation for the same chains which I put into a many chain system, and I simulate the whole thing. And then I want to compare these two things to see if that single chain approach makes sense or not. And if it doesn't make sense, then we come to all of Michael's. I mean, that's sort of getting an answer to one of.
Can you put that chain in a grid of fixed observables and do the simulation in that case?
I think that is probably the best way of doing it. I always wanted to have something which is like an harmonic potential, because that makes it much easier to link it to the other stuff and maybe even to solve it, of course. Because, I mean, I don't want to stop there, of course. I want to get so much understanding I can solve it. But that might be the simplest.
Well, instead of being fixed, they can elastically move about.
Which then comes to Michael's question, how should we really model the confining potential? Should it be rigid? Should it be a harmonic thing? Should it be a thing which has holes in between so that the loops can make excursions? I think that is reasonable. But Michael is sort of, he has all the answers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm now allowed to give an answer.
Yes, that was the trick, right? We were giving.
You put your chain and force it to go through a slip links. The slip links not fixed in space, they attach to the background. Mm-hmm. With by spring.
Mm-hmm.
And then as chain moves along, you're able to remove those distance from the end.
I thought about that one. Now, what always, where I got stuck is the following question. If you do that for a ring polymer, right? And I like to look at situations where I take out the dynamics, where I have sort of a quenched topology, and then I'm back to a statistical mechanics problem. I don't even have to think about the dynamics of this. Then what I have to know is, if you put these slip rings here, and then your spring somewhere, I have to know where I should put the anchors for the slip. Now I know how to do it. If these are not slip links, then I'm perfectly happy. But if they are slip links, I don't know the algorithm for choosing the origins of these things.
You have a difficult problem with the ring. The ring is entangled with the slip and the linear chain. It's a sociopath. It doesn't want to associate with the outside world. So you have to construct something with a regular
macromolecule. But still, whenever you do it, what you have to have is an algorithm which produces the right single chain statistics.
We have two things that actually. You're talking about the real metal of rings. And he talks about
an Olympic gel.
I'm talking about the real world. He's not talking about the real world.
Now, I thought you were going to say that the problem with the rings is that the rings in the slip links is that the ring ain't going to get fused anywhere.
Exactly, that's why I like them.
Right. But of course, a ring in the melt that's not linked with other rings is going to get fused.
Oh, this is an Olympic gel.
This is a model Olympic gel. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't say that. Sort of. Locally, it should always look sort of the same as a melt of linear polymers, except that if I close the thing, I destroy all possibilities of constraint release, reptation, whatever. So I have really a static problem. I don't have to worry about the dynamics.
Suppose you start off with crosslinks at the appropriate distance, depending how many you have, and to equilibrate the system, maybe even with an additional equilibration that involves monomer addition equilibration between the segments, and then in the chemical potentials, then turn them into slip rings. Then to your simulation.
But we don't know if that is going to work, right? I mean, my sort of what worries me is, do we have to solve the problem first before we get the algorithm to look at it? But Michael says he knows how to do it.
If you prepare your Olympic network in equilibrium before cross-linking, what happens is, what you do is this is the problem with Edwards' initial model. Edwards put sentencing potential along the primitive bank,
which is wrong. Yes.
What you should do is you start with your conformation and this springs, which are like virtual chains, and part of your chain going to the next spring to the cross link has to have a perfect Gaussian statistic. If you do that initially, you're perfectly done. This is going to improve the equilibrium. So the whole thing starting from every point back in the space, going through this virtual chain to the slip link, continuing through your chain, going back to the next link to the network, all of those things have satisfied ideal Gaussian statistics. Then you're done if you put equilibrium. So the system would always be.
And then if I let it run, it will work.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try that out. So, good.
So these have to go through the
earthquake springs
have to go through the next
step. You're looking at the preparation state. Yeah. After you're preparing it to your front, you're looking at the initial preparation state. Where to put a pattern for? So you start with your backbone, and from it you randomly draw those virtual springs to any possible places in space randomly. That will be perfect confinement. This will give you the recipe.
For slip links.
For pattern loop.
No, that's for anything.
Right. In the middle of it from the chain, that will give the right piece of the thing. And the chain moves, gets out of one thing, that's the connection.
I'm going to try to find answers to see who, how you or somebody else shoots it down. It's not clear what's wrong with this. Couldn't you do a correlation, you know, that is a mean square displacement for a tracer particle? And if I match that on the predictions of the tube model, including both the time regime before disengagement and the crossover to disengagement, wouldn't I get, I imagine the tube model makes a clear prediction for the shape of that function that depends only on the random walk nature of the tube at length scales longer than the tube diameter.
Well, the thing why I want to have this is that, and I think we have heard hints to that also this morning, is that I think we have to worry about what happens to the tube under strain. And only if I sort of have this full model and then I do something to whatever we find reasonable, I can make this explicit comparison to what the same chain is doing as part of a many-chain system.
Well, I'm taking your suggestion of saying, let's forget rheology for the moment and just do equilibrium dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
My suggestion earlier was that equilibrium dynamics and rheology don't have to be all that closely related, but I might decouple the plateau modulus from the tube diameter that you see in equilibrium dynamics. But the proposal or question is, you know, wouldn't the tube model give you a clear prediction for any mean square displacement you wish that you could try to match? It would have just two diameters
Well, the problem is always that sort of it is treated as a one-dimensional problem in a straight tube, and there you can do calculations. I mean, that's what Alexei is doing. But when it comes to wrapping this whole thing up in three dimensions, that is not so obvious how it works.
No, I make the correlation function in three dimensions. That is, you get the 20 power laws. The 1/4 power law is coming from doing one-dimensional diffusion a random walk.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that the prefactor of that power law involves the tube diameter.
Yeah. But still, I mean, I want to have the thing in three dimensions. The definition of this model in three dimensions. And that doesn't seem to be so obvious. I mean, even sort of if the tube is curved and all of that, I'm not so sure that the monomers react to this how are they distributed in this tube? Is that related somehow to curvature of the tube? Because sometimes it looks like that. And it just worries me that we are talking about a model all the time, which we can nicely solve in one dimension. And then we say, folding this whole thing up into three dimensions is trivial. And I run into trouble when I try. OK, maybe I'm particularly stupid, but it just worries me a bit.
Suppose you take random walk in three dimensions. And then you say that at every point of this line, random line in three dimensions, force acting on the perpendicular direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's universal. It's not slipping. It's on a
can
you cross grain up to two diameters?
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think you can
draw a
smooth.
I think you can draw a smooth line through n points, parameterizing it by m Rouse modes.
Well,
here, you do have to introduce the parameter. Which is what? Yes. Yeah. The question very simple is length. But if that length is the same as your step length, is the minimum length you can put it?
Suppose it's large. The two diameters are larger than the cool step.
That's why I was saying focus on correlations at times longer than tau either.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, larger distances.
Mm-hmm.
The actual tube contour is ambiguous at short length, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's ambiguous over larger distances.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is related to the problem of just doing the inverse, right? It's sort of, we would be in the fortunate positions. We have all modern positions as a function of time, and then people will always come and say, "Well, just measure the tube," and then then I say, "But what exactly do you want me to measure, right? Or measure the displacements parallel and perpendicular to the tube?" But that implies that I have to define it first, and then it always seems so simple. And then if you just try to do the stupid thing to define this, you get stuck at some point.
Even if you're not with the fluorescent labels, you can actually look at them, you know, in the microscope.
That's, but it's... Yeah, but it's much, it's much, much simpler for the semi-flexural ones, because this whole thing is I think, more transparent how it works.
But I would say even there, there's no clear result.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Lee, how much is there really produced by choosing different algorithms for putting a line through your force grain chain? Suppose we can have different algorithms. Why is it the problem? The question is how do you define direction this line? It's random walk. Smooth cross-grained line, but the smooth cross-grained line has the length scale of its definition, and the length scale which is turned to the same length scale. So let's leave that skip diameter. So you cannot do it perpendicularly because that's just that. It's your minimum distance.
So you mean that the error will be a quarter of the same thing over the thing?
Well, if you talk about direction, I will be a quarter of 5 by 2.
But on the other hand, I have in mind, Ralph, you sort of use, I think, helpfully, the two different words, the tube and the sausage.
Yeah.
Meaning two rather different things. And the statistics of the tube being the anchor points of this potential, which is bizarrely disconnected object. But the sausage being what Kirk and Gary manifestly showed us all in 1993, whatever it was, and Jacob, there was a series of snapshots of single chains, mm-hmm. superimposed, mm-hmm. Over a time scale much shorter than rotation time. Behold, these things were in a nice bundle cylinder thing, mm-hmm. bent at the molecular weight of that NE. There's a coarse-grained object. I think, you know, what this is getting at is suppose you choose a length scale, which is a little bit larger than a step length, but not much larger than a step length. I could imagine drawing a line through those simulated sausages, and making errors of 10-20% perhaps, but not doing much worse than that.
Mm-hmm. So I think of those pictures probably done on atypical chains.
We have the order here.
Not necessarily, but the problem is it's extremely difficult to distinguish between perpendicular and parallel motion because this cube cross-grain chain is a very flexible object, mm-hmm. at least for these models. Mm-hmm. And it becomes better, even better, and bigger, if you go to a system where essentially the tube becomes very tiny compared to the intrinsic stiffness of the system.
The first simple problem, Tom, is just this tube here. Let's stick with the yellow. This is a bent object, right? And of course, now you want to say there is a monomer, and this monomer is somewhere, so the monomer is going to be here. Now, where exactly is it in the tube? I mean, here. I mean, you can imagine zillions of positions, and that is defining the longitudinal motion by projecting it on the tube axis and saying that's how far it got.
Well, it's inverse. In principle, the tube can be modeled as a walk of very soft spheres, which can significantly overlap with themselves, mm-hmm. also on a fairly short scale. And that's where the problem really comes from.
But if you were to, by round count, pin the chain, so it looks like a very mildly entangled network, just so this chain doesn't go anywhere, and just do a big run, mm-hmm. and you integrate as long as you please, and you build up a density distribution of all monomers on that chain only, irrespective of where they are. So you just integrate, and you That won't change with time because you're getting it may take a huge amount of simulation.
Well, that's just how we do
it. Then you have, you eventually converge to a smooth distribution, a row of R in three-dimensional space, which if you looked at it would have the sort of
that's what essentially we tried to do.
Yeah. You tried to do it, you couldn't do it. Could you have done it if you had 100 times more people?
No, I think that we could have done it if you the small
system. But if at any given time, you make all monomers of all other chains fix these shapes. And then you take your own shape and leave it on at the end. Don't you find that they will define what each time?
That's the next thing we do.
And you can do that several times and see the persistence of that line.
Yeah, that's the next thing
that's
we have on the menu.
You, the original group defined,
that's right.
Yeah. And that sort of works. I mean, I don't see any reason not to do it simultaneously for all chains. And then you really get a nice, sort of a nice thing where you have kings and...
You have to apply a tension. And in order to resist that tension, you have to make infinitely rigid all the rest. Otherwise, you make motion space.
Yeah, one can just do it simultaneously. You fix the endpoint of all chains, and then you let the contours shrink. They do it simultaneously, and so if this was wobbly before, at some point, they just do this. Yeah. At least what I have in mind, sort of we tried it, it works, but...
But then you don't define with the... You can define the contour of a tube this way by either doing this and pulling, that has been done, or you can do by averaging, you can get the contour of a tube. I think, Kurt, if you agree with me, you can, from your calculation, you still get a contour. You cannot get a perpendicular direction. You cannot get a diameter.
Yeah.
You can clearly, contour is not an issue.
Contour is possible.
Contour is trivial. You can do it either way.
Can I find perpendicular to this contour?
There is no perpendicular to this contour, that's the point. Because it's random walk.
From straight lines connected.
It's not a straight line.
They don't have any printed surface.
Yeah.
Yes.
You do not have
so you can edges, sharp edges where you can.
Not edges,
it's non-differentiable. That's the
right. Exactly.
Now, I'm going to try this. I think I provided an answer, and I don't think I got it. And I don't think it's been shot down. I say the tube is, the tube contour is simply not well defined without a specific coarse grain procedure at length scales for the tube diameter. And it's just, it's got to depend on some arbitrary choice of how you coarse grade it or what you choose.
Okay, then let's take up Tom's suggestion and I use my favorite word, sausage. Let's say the tube is the confining potential, the sausage is what you see. And you are allowed to model what you see in whatever kind of model. I mean, you can take fixed obstacles, you can take slip links, you can do whatever. So the sausage axis, one can determine by averaging. That's what Michael is saying. That is clear. One can just do it.
Okay, so suppose I define the sausage by averaging over times up to tau e. Remember, there's an arbitrary choice. Why not half tau e or twice tau e? I have trouble imagining that there's not always some ambiguity in exactly how smooth that sausage is. Okay, what I'm trying to say is that maybe there is a universal theory if you look at how monomers move over longer times. Just like, that if I look at the three-dimensional mean square displacement of a chain over much longer times, that there, I guess I haven't proven this, but I still suspect that there's a universal behavior with a prefactor, and all you're really trying to do is identify that prefactor in the behavior at times greater than tau e.
Well, but the fact remains that what you're doing is you say, I can do a calculation in one dimension, and I can fold the thing up. Now, there's indications from experiments that something happens to this tube, whatever that is. And sort of, I'm just trying to ask the very naive question, I'm not going to solve anything here, right? I mean, let's just say we define the model, but we really specify what happens to the thing, and I'm just going to try it out. And now I'm going to see if that looks like what I see for the chain which is part of the many-chain system. And if it makes sense, we give it to the smart people who just solve it. But let's just try out the idea, and then I run into trouble even just defining it, and that worries me.
Here's the concrete suggestion is same functional form for the Mainsburg displacement of a tracer molecule follows the behavior predicted by the tube model, which has a single, which has a limited number of free parameters in it.
So you mean T to the one quarter behavior, these things?
T to the one quarter,
You see it sort of in some.
I'm not saying test movements.
Yeah.
I'm saying that's your test.
Yeah.
When you have a system, for instance, where the tube diameter is so large, but you can be a well shaped in the field, and these are the most often think of what water regime. That's my responding
to here. Come on. I specify that one shouldn't look at early times. I'm saying you should look at the way across the world.
Okay. Let's continue to overlap.
Even one
Thanks.
Question is too much.
Thank you.